This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Everybody has that one family member who they know they can turn to for family stories or lineage. In the world of social science, this person is called the kinkeeper. And for years, the work of the kinkeeper has mostly revolved around talking with aging relatives or sorting through old photo albums and boxes of paperwork sitting in the back corner of the attic. But now, Americans are turning much more to advanced technology to trace their genealogy. As of 2014, more than a million Americans have taken a DNA test to find links to their past. My guest today has documented the phenomenon in her new book, The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. Alondra Nelson is the Dean of Social Science and a Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Columbia University. She's going to be at Duke University talking about her research this coming Tuesday afternoon, but joins us for a preview. Alondra Nelson, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a bit about how you got started in documenting this phenomenon.
As you suggested in the beginning, I was a kinkeeper in my family as a child. I was the one that was trying to tell the stories and ask the questions. As I got older, and I think part of that curiosity is actually what made me become a scholar. You know, you kind of carry these questions with you that you want to answer. And then in 2002 and 2003, when genetic ancestry testing was really beginning, the direct-to-consumer genetics industry was beginning in the United States. It had started in the UK a couple of years before, I started to see a couple of news articles suggesting that this might be a tool, an avenue for helping African Americans to trace their roots, that it might be a kind of renaissance of a roots movement of almost 40 years ago. And I'm a scholar who works on science and African American history and the histories of medicine and science in Black communities. And so I thought I could not work on this topic.
Well, that takes us to the focus of your book, where you examine a variety of case studies. Tell us a bit about the African American burial ground and how that fits into this story.
Sure. So the African burial ground, which is in Lower Manhattan, was uncovered in 1991, as we often uncover centuries-old sites where somebody's planning to do some construction. In this case, it was the General Services Administration, and they were going to put up a new building. And there had been some fleeting evidence that perhaps this where they were going to do this construction sort of was beside or maybe abutted a burial ground, but they weren't sure that they were on top of a burial ground. And they start the work, and lo and behold, it's a cemetery. And it turns out to be what is the largest and most historic cemetery or burial ground of African, colonial African, enslaved African remains in the United States, and it's now a national monument. So it goes from being a construction site to a research site. By the mid-1990s, the research has been brought to the Howard University Anthropology Lab, the Montague Lab, and it becomes an interdisciplinary research project that includes archaeological analysis, historical analysis. People are doing analysis of dental remains, of dental morphology. And then there was an attempt to also use what was then very early genetic analysis to try to get a sense of what this researchers called the macroethnic affiliations of the formerly enslaved Africans who were buried there.
And what does that mean? The macro.
It means that macroethnic. So, it means that we have the idea or the sort of category or the social status of African American, and Africa is a continent, and we have African American as an identity in part because people of African descent, people who are the descendants of slaves, aren't able to access through archival records often identities that go before their ancestors were brought here as part of the transnational slave trade. So what the Burial Ground Project proposes to do, there are a few researchers working on it, is to create a reference database of contemporary African DNA. And to the extent with the then very primitive techniques, they were able to extract and amplify genetic samples from the remains. They were going to compare them to this database of contemporary DNA, and through that comparison sort of make some inferences about where these colonial African Americans might have been from on the continent of Africa.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. That research project becomes, in a few years' time, the African Ancestry Company, which is one of the first direct-to-consumer genetic ancestry testing companies in the United States, and I think the first and only black-owned company.
So tell us then, because that brings us from the macro to the micro. That's when individuals then go in the other direction and find out, try to make personal connections. How personal can those connections be? Can I, you know, make my way back to a region somewhere or individuals along the way? How micro can it get, I guess, is my question.
It depends on the type of analysis the company uses. So the African Ancestry Company uses mitochondrial DNA analysis or Y chromosome DNA analysis, which trace the matrilineage or the mother's line or the on the one hand or the father's line on the other hand. And these don't really give you a time. You know, the results you get will give you an ethnic group or an ethnic inference. So in my case, it was inference to the Bamileke group of Cameroon. It doesn't tell you that finding how many ancestors back in time, where in time. So what it's sort of making a guess about is what your set of genetic markers compared to this database, what's the best match or what's the most frequent match in this database. And that doesn't mean it's the only match. It doesn't mean that a match might not be found in other places besides the African continent, but it's the best match, the best guess that they're making using this particular database.
And you talk about the value of this kind of research and the case studies that you write about in your book. And I think the Isaiah Washington case, that you point out and illustrate in your book, it gives us a good sense of how this can be important to someone.
Sure. The example of Isaiah Washington, the actor who your listeners might recall from Grey's Anatomy, and now he's on a show, I think, called The 100 on CW, and he's been in various movies, had always been someone who was interested in his African ancestry and had been, you know, what we might call sort of an Afrocentric kind of, you know, person in the way he dressed and the things that he read and the way he lived his life, African-centered at the very least, if not Afrocentric. And in 2004, he wins a film award at a Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles. And part of his swag bag for this award ceremony is an African ancestry, genetic ancestry test kit. So he does that test, and he learns that he is related to the Mende group of Sierra Leone, or he's inferred to be related to them or affiliated with them on the maternal line, and a group in Angola on the paternal line. And this really takes him on a new journey in life for someone who had been generally interested in Africa in a general sense to being more specifically interested. I follow many genetic genealogists over the course of this decade of research, and one of them is Isaiah Washington, who soon after getting his test results begins to refer to himself as a DNA Sierra Leonean, and it sort of has a shift in his identity. And I have a couple of encounters with him. One is in South Carolina near Charleston. On the banks of the Ashley River, Isaiah participates with a larger group of people who call themselves DNA Sierra Leoneans in a ceremony of remembrance for their ancestors. So ancestors who would have been brought from what is now contemporary Sierra Leone as part of the Middle Passage, as part of the slave trade, and brought to the shores of the Ashley River in South Carolina. And these are mostly, we know through linguistic records and historic records, the people who reside now, the people of African descent who reside now in the Carolina Low Countries, who are the Gullah and Geechee people. And so there's a ceremony there with DNA Sierra Leoneans. An immigrant to the United States from Sierra Leone serves as the officiant of the ceremony, which is called a SARA, S-A-R-A. And, you know, people sort of have a moment of remembrance for ancestors lost who might have been lost in the slave trade. This immigrant, Amadou Massali, has brought with him soil from Sierra Leone that he throws into the Ashley River to rest the souls of ancestors who have been brought from Sierra Leone. And they also have a ceremony where they rest a wreath in the river to commemorate the ancestors. So there's a kind of, after people get their individual results, what this Washington and DNA Sierra Leonean example suggests is that they become social practices, that the tests themselves are social practices, mm-hmm. and they're social practices that inaugurate or catalyze other kinds of social practice. And in this case, it was a practice of healing or reconciliation around slave trade and kinship and ancestry.
And this can be important for the individuals involved, but you also write about the implications, larger implications, and the way genetic ancestry is used in a novel case for reparations. Tell us about the Farmer Pillman class action suit.
Yes, that's a fascinating historic case. And so reparations has been quite a bit in the news these days, from Ta-Nehisi Coates a couple of years ago to Bernie Sanders just a few days ago. And it had been, it's a longstanding, you know, debate, struggle, a site of advocacy for many African-American activists, one of whom is Deidre Farmer Pillman. And in 2002, she files with seven other plaintiffs a class action suit for reparations for slavery against 20 U.S. companies, or, well, 20 multinational companies that still exist today and that in the past had some ties to the slave trade. So these were companies like Lloyd's of London that might have enslaved, that might have insured former enslaved people on behalf of their owners. There are companies like CSX that might have made profits from transporting enslaved people across the country on train lines and these sorts of things. And the court, in a first finding in this case, says that the plaintiffs don't have standing, which means that they can't demonstrate that they are the injured party, that they're the direct descendants of injured parties to whom reparations might be owed. So, you know, the court sort of is saying, and it says later in a decision that's written by an appellate judge named Charles Norgel, yes, it's the case that, you know, obviously you're people of African descent, but we can't prove that you are the direct descendants of slaves. So the plaintiffs in 2003, just as the African Ancestry Company is really getting underway, go to the company. They show up at the headquarters and they purchase test kits from the company, and they take their results and introduce them as evidence in the case to prove that they're descendants of slaves. And so, as we discussed at the beginning, Frank, you know, it's these are macro. We might call these macro, still macro ethnic affiliations. Mm-hmm. They're so the some of the inferences they received was one person was inferred to be related to a group in the Gambia, another in Niger, and other places, mostly in West Africa. But these were kind of wide, you know, these are nation states, ethnic groups, language groups. They're not specific individuals. And ultimately, the court required a kind of genealogy that genetic ancestry testing can't quite provide.
But it is a hint at how this can be used in a larger sense.
Precisely.
But I also think this kind of analysis is a double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing to say that the humanity traces its roots to the Rift Valley and therefore we all have something in common. But then you start looking at the variations and how they've evolved, and that can be the basis for distinctions that can be turned to racist ends. And you write about this in your book. I'm thinking here about the New York Times science reporter Nicholas Wade in his book.
Yes. I'm forgetting what it's called. The Troublesome Inheritance, maybe?
I think that's it. Troubled Inheritance, yeah. Or Troublesome,
You know, it's an interesting, you know, the paradox of the Human Genome Project and of genetics as it's evolved as a science, I think, is really encapsulated by Mary Claire King, who's a very prominent genetic scientist at the University of Washington, who says, you know, the Human Genome Project, genetic science, shows us that everybody's different and everybody's the same. And so, you know, it's a social and political choice, I think, you know, whether or not we're going to focus on the 99.9% in which we're alike or the 0.1% that were different. And that's really become so much of what we're basing our hopes on with regards to, you know, medical advances and indeed with regards to identity. And, you know, it goes too far, of course. One might be empathetic about why certain groups, adoptees, people of African descent who don't have any other way to get evidence of their ancestry besides genetic ancestry testing might be compelled by it, while also wanting to be cautious of, you know, the history of eugenics, the history of scientific racism that precedes these very techniques. It's another thing to do what Nicholas Wade does in his book, which is to make very large, very very discriminatory, very prejudiced leaps from one scientific paper, one scientific finding, sometimes reading papers and findings wrong or exaggerating them, to say things like, people from to basically underscore longstanding racial stereotypes, so that people, he makes claims that, genetics proves that people from Asia are industrious and that, that people from the continent of Africa or people with African ancestry are not industrious. And so it becomes, the whole argument is a kind of tautology. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy of, centuries old stereotypes that he kind of cherry picks genetic papers, genetic evidence to use to make similar claims in the 21st century.
It certainly is gaining in popularity if judged by the number of TV shows, Finding Your Roots, et cetera. What do you make of that, and how do they contribute, or do they, to, sort of the more serious uses of this?
That's such an interesting question. So I started doing this work before those shows were on American television. And so, I write in the book about the practice of the reveal, which is what these reality television genetic ancestry testing shows are so expert at, the emotion of revealing to people knowledge that they didn't know, couldn't know, might not have known otherwise. And so what's been fascinating for me to watch is that the reveal has become part of the social practice of genetic ancestry testing. In 2002, 2003, 2004, when I was beginning to interview people and talk to people about whether and why they might do this and their experience using the tests, there was not yet a sense that part of the genetic ancestry testing ritual was that you had to have an emotional reveal. And so over the arc of the decade of my work, the reveal becomes more and more important as part of what it means to do genetic ancestry testing, such that people who are non-celebrities, who won't necessarily therefore appear on Who Do You Think You are making their own YouTube videos. So they make their own YouTube videos. They show themselves taking the test. They show themselves doing their own reveal to share with friends and people in their social media network.
Fascinating stuff, Alondra. Wish we had more time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's a real pleasure.
Alondra Nelson is the Dean of Social Science at Columbia University. She's going to be talking about her new book, The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome, at Duke University this Tuesday at 1, the Rhodes Conference Room. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.